Welcome to Ears on Art. This is part two of a conversation that co-hosts Stephen DeLuque and I, Krissa Hewitt, are having with sculptor, glassblower, George Jurcich. George taught glassblowing and glass fusing at Cal Poly for 35 years and retired officially in 2011. If you missed it, last week's show is available on the KCBX archives under Ears on Art. George was giving us some of the history of glass in terms of contemporary education, meaning what has been happening since the mid-60s in the States. And so that is some of my reference as we begin. Today, George will discuss his own artwork and some of the enjoyable encounters he's had with the people and the discipline over the years. We head now to Los Osos.
Good afternoon. We are here at the studio of George Jurcich. Say hello.
Hello.
And of course, Krissa is here as well.
Hi there. I actually have blown maybe two pieces of glass in my life and recognize how difficult it is. It's been a discipline since I don't know when.
It was 3,000 years ago.
Okay, so I mean, we've got a track record here. But in terms of people having access to it and really developing it as a life endeavor, it's relatively recent. That's very exciting. Even though I could kind of think I knew the history to realize all the parts that were missing. So thanks, George.
Sure. Oh, hey.
Once a teacher, always a teacher.
Exactly.
I've learned that since I've left teaching that, unfortunately, I'm kind of stuck in a teacher's frame of mind. I'm having a very hard time like wrapping my mind around marketing and things that commercial, you know, artists have to do. And I haven't had to really rely on that. So my learning curve is very slow. I'm trying to get it off the ground, but I'm realizing that, you know what? I'm getting tired.
It is a whole nother job.
It sure is. Oh my goodness.
How did you start in your art career?
Well, I was a kind of a surfer who hung around the beaches at Capitola, Santa Cruz area. My mother was an oil painter and a watercolorist, and she began to paint when she was retired, when I was actually a very young boy. My parents were sort of a generation older than most parents of children my age, so they were parents of, I would call them, of life wisdom as opposed to life energy. As a consequence, they were at home, retired, when I was still kind of a fledgling. And my mother, particularly, was not that concerned that I find a field that was going to be financially successful primarily. She just wanted me to find something that was personally enriching, and that was what she was pursuing. So my mother painted for 30 years. In fact, during my lifetime, she was not only a mentor, she was also a supporter. She made certain things possible that I think were unique. She traveled a lot. Sometimes I traveled with her. Other times I would share my travels with her if she let me go on my own. One of the greatest things that I think she allowed me to do was go to Washington State my first summer after my first year of San Jose State to study glass at Pilchuck School with Dale Chihuly. That was a huge opportunity. There was nothing there. It was like a rainforest, and we had to build a glass school, and it was the craziest thing. You know, I was living out in the forest under a tent roof, rain coming down.
This is sounding all too familiar.
Yeah, well, I think that was the thing that allowed me to accomplish what I did at Cal Poly, because once you did those things in the wild, you realize that you could do it anywhere. You know, again, going back to my mother, she trusted that I would be okay and that I could go away for 3 months and that I would survive the whole experience. And so I did it. And that was very important, I think, in my early development.
No, I was just going to say that Dale Trihuly's brother-in-law lives here in San Luis Obispo.
Yes, right. I think it was in 2008, one of Chris and my colleagues, Jim App Roberts, he called me up one day and he said, I think Dale Trihuly's wandering around in my neighborhood off of Foothill. And I went, what? And so I wasn't going to call Dale, but I called Seattle and got his secretary. And I said, where's Dale Trihuly? I'm the professor, you know, Glass at Cal Poly, San Luis Obispo. And she said, well, he's in San Luis Obispo. I said, well, how do I get in touch with him? He said, well, you can leave him a note through me. I said, well, look, here's what we'd like to do. We'd like to invite him back next year at our dime to have him do a lecture. Just run that past him and see what he says. So he got back in touch with me and he said, George, he said, hi, how's it going? I haven't seen you for 20 years. I said, well, yeah, but, well, why don't you come next year? When are you coming back? Thanksgiving? He said, yeah. I said, okay, we'll have a lecture set up for you. Let's get you down here. So he said, okay, well, let's do it. So that's how that came about. And then when he came back, we had the greatest time. Will Carlton, another local glassblower, he had this holiday sale at his Tiber Canyon Ranch. So when Dale was in town, we said, hey, Dale, you got to come see Tiber Canyon Ranch. So we went over there, and Will was just completely amazed that, you know, Dale had showed up. And he brought his son, Jackson. Dale tried to teach Jackson how to blow glass, but Dale's too high energy, and Jackson gets too nervous, you know, being around his dad, who's this huge figure in glass. So Dale said, George, you teach Jackson how to make a bubble. So I put Jackson together with another young boy, and these two became a team, and we went through and we made some stuff over there at Tiber Canyon. It was really cool. And Dale was going, you know what, you have the patience of Job compared to me, you know, because Dale just couldn't slow down. And that was also a great experience, really, to be able to show Jackson how to make a bubble. Dale Trihuly's son, right?
Okay, what's backwards about this, right? George, do you have a sense of what it was about glass that really captured you?
I tried to touch on that earlier. I was a surfer. My mother inspired me, but the other thing that inspired me was the ocean and fluid motion, things that move in a liquid fashion. In art school, I became aware of a few artists that worked in fluids, such as Ed Ruscha, who did a lot of watercolor prints of liquid that became graphics, like a liquid word almost. Beautiful stuff. Also, Ron Mallory, who was a kinetic artist in the San Francisco Bay Area, who used to mill these rotating discs that had glycerin and mercury in them. And as the disc rotated, you could see the fluid trickle between an airspace and a thin section between two plexiglass sheets, and the intermingling of the mercury globules and the glycerin rising through it. And I was just really interested in how fluids always worked. So glass is a fluid when it's molten, but when you dangle it off the end of a pipe and it freezes, it becomes that frozen moment in time of that fluid. I guess that's always been an intrigue to me, is that you're forming something that's really a drip, but when do you stop it? And when you stop it, it becomes that frozen moment in time, which was your decision of when it stopped moving. It's very affected by gravity. It can be inflated, so you can stretch it from the inside. You can poke it from the outside. You can color it. You can quench it. You can do a whole bunch of things to it. It's almost like you put it through a torture moveset, changing it into what it becomes. The experience of the artist, I think, is to explore all that, just to take it like a test pilot would take a new airplane up in the air. You know, you're trying to explore this stuff, get out of it what you think it can do. And that's been the fascination for me.
I'm thinking that for most disciplines, there's kind of a personality that accepts the aspect of that material, too? I mean, you've got to go with the flow, as they say, more than you being able to totally control it.
It's more like you coach it into shape. It's a material that is your partner in a kind of a whirling dance of material and human motion. It's like you're kind of a choreographer of the partner that you have, which is the liquid that's out on the end of the stick, and you're trying to pull it into some kind of final form that you agree upon, you know, with the glass itself.
It's a negotiation.
It is, yeah. It is, right. Exactly. That's probably how most of it comes about. Lately, I have some things I'm trying to echo, like nature, and I have other things that are more about that movement or that fluid thing that gets explored because, well, you just want to see what happened. Not all of them have a literal idea behind them. More, some of them are more experimental. Like that one I call the Navigator. It's just a dangling ball above another one, but the upper ball moves. So I'm hoping that the viewer will move the ball, you know, mm-hmm. and they can see what they see in it as it moves.
And you were also being able to make use of relatively new kinds of adhesives that allowed you yep. to work sculpturally in a different sense with cold parts as opposed to dangling all these things that wanted to drop to the floor on the molten state.
There are certain things you want to see as a final product that you can't manage all at one time on the end of a blowpipe. So you have to begin to work in constructions, which become larger holes as a sum of parts. You can't all do that with heat. Although lately, I will say that in the smaller scale, the lamp workers or the torch workers have been able to manage some tremendous things I've never seen. I would never have thought were possible. Even making machines that work out of crystal. Andy Pico with his spinning wheel, for example. But I have pursued mostly the cold assembly technique, which is grinding and fitting parts together and then using various adhesives, silicone, epoxy, ultraviolet setting cement, sun glue, they call that, and various other adhesives to create larger constructions. I would prefer to use any mechanical device I could to create, to connect the glass together, but it's not always a viable alternative.
So the direction that you're going now, do you want to expand on that or what feels different about it than 10 years ago or 5 years ago?
Yeah. Well, you know, I had a show in the Galleria in the Student Union. There were a number of pieces that were exploratory, most of them adhesively connected together. I got some very good reviews with that. I filled the whole room with, I don't know, 40 or 50 pieces. But the problem was, I got the feeling that they left people like going, what was that? What is that? It got me thinking, well, maybe I need to make something that refers to something from their real world that they can respond to. So I began a series of objects which I called the Objects of Hopeless Utility. And they were things that you would find in everyday life, like a tractor or a chainsaw or an outboard motor or a leaf blower or an electric drill or made out of glass. You know, have people ask the question, what is this made of? And why would anybody do this? I mean, and yet you have this whole spectrum of color. You can make it almost look exactly like a John Deere or a Makita. That was my second break in the series. But, you know, as I retired and I started working at home, I started to think about, like, environments like the desert and the aviary and the marine environment and put them into environmental context. So I began to work in areas where I'd rather do an installation of a number of glass objects instead of only one. Dale Chihuly is really a pioneer in this, and I've seen a number of his installations. It just sort of opened my mind to not think about one object, but think about the whole composition of a number of objects. Maybe they don't have to be connected together. Maybe they can just be in a setting. That joins them into one concept, you know, like a cactus garden or a pond, a wetlands environment, like a tide pool, you know. Lately, that's been more the way I've been going with the natural stuff.
What would you like people to most know about your work or George Dersich?
Well, I'd like to think I was instrumental in spreading the word about glass as a medium for our other artists who have the enthusiasm to begin to work with it. And I hope that, you know, somehow through objects I've made and things that I've managed to create, you know, I pass some of that enthusiasm on to that audience so that they find other opportunities to begin their own exploration of this medium. To me, just a fascinating thing. I mean, I'm ready to turn on my oven in a couple of days and start my next series of things. I mean, I don't feel at all that I'm done. I have a whole bunch of drawings still on my sketch pad that I have in my next group of things that I want to accomplish. So I'd like to see others find that kind of enthusiasm if they could. And I feel like I have given that to some of my students and people I've come in contact with. So, yeah, it's been a good path, a good run, and yeah, I hope to continue it.
Having taught in the classroom next door to George for close to 20 years, I can certainly attest to the enthusiasm. Easy to see students get hooked and not want to leave that facility. How do you initiate an idea? And are you drawing things out? Are you just thinking them and blowing them? How do you approach that?
Both. I do some pre-drawing. Sometimes I'll be at a show and I'll be bored sitting waiting for customers. I just look off and I see a bird, you know, he's pulling a berry off of a vine. The best thing to do is always look at nature and try to get the idea from the real world. Don't try to get ideas from other glass things. At least that would be people in my medium would tend towards that. They go, oh, I can make that. I can, you know, and they think they can do it better. I would just soon not worry about whether I can do it better. I just want to do it like I have watched it from my own observation somewhere in the real world and adapt that to my idea. That's how I would prefer to work. If I know I'm not going to have the furnace on and I'm not going to be able to work with glass, then I try to jot down ideas as, you know, they come up. That's really what I'm about to do when I turn the furnace on, is to go back into my sketchbook and go through my old ideas and start adapting them to the real glass.
Are the sketches more just outlines and then you let the serendipity happen?
Yeah, they're kind of rough. They're not very specific, just really kind of sketches. Sometimes they're even just a list of steps I want to take to make something, like start a whole 1 through 12 list of things that need to be done first and second and so on until, you know, I get the general thing formed up, and then it becomes more like, okay, I've gotten this far, now what? You know, now I have to make the final move, but I kind of know a little bit about what I want. It's just that there's always a surprise, hopefully, at the end.
Well, thank you, George. It's been a very educational and delightful afternoon, and thank you for sharing your time with us.
Oh, well, thank you both for coming, Stephen and Krissa, and hope that, you know, I've said something that someone might take to heart and think, you know, wow, there's somebody out there that's actually doing something, and many people are. So I hope that, I wish them success in their own endeavors.
More and more, I think Stephen and I just keep trying to say, just take a risk, take a chance, just go play at something, because it's worth the time.
And it's okay to fail.
Absolutely. Thank you, George.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
Today's guest was George Dersich, glassblower and sculptor from Los Osos. If you missed part one of his program, you can find it at the KCBX website under Ears on Art. On behalf of co-host Stephen DeLuque, this is Krissa Hewitt, thanking you so much for listening.